From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's not a matter of if the coronavirus will spread across the United States, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned this week. It's simply a question of when. President Donald Trump tried to reassure Americans in a special news conference last night.
We're very, very ready for this, for anything, whether it's going to be a breakout of larger proportions or whether or not we're at that very low level.
Trump also named Vice President Mike Pence to lead his administration's response to coronavirus, a response that thus far has generated mounting criticism for being too slow as the virus continues to spread quickly across the globe. In fact, also yesterday, the CDC announced the first case involving a person who did not travel to China, the first case in the U.S. of what's known as community spread. So this hour on Point, a close examination of the state of U.S. preparedness for coronavirus. And we'll begin today with Jeremy Kneindijk. He is a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development, and he's also former director of USAID's Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance. He served on a World Health Organization's advisory group about outbreaks and emergencies in 2015 and 2016. Jeremy, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
I should also note that you wrote a recent op-ed in the Washington Post. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. And you actually led the U.S. government's humanitarian responses on the Ebola outbreak, or one of the Ebola outbreaks in West Africa. So you know a lot about preparedness and communications during times of the spread of disease around the world. When you heard the president speak last night and the vice president and the various members of his administration and the medical community, were you reassured by what you heard?
I don't think that press conference last night accomplished what it needed to. I think that that was a really important opportunity, certainly the highest profile communications moment that we've seen out of the U.S. government so far since the outbreak was announced about 2 months ago. So it was an important opportunity to provide credible, detailed, transparent information. And the day before, the Secretary of Health and Human Services had promised radical transparency in a press conference he'd done. I don't think we saw radical transparency yesterday. I was concerned on a few points. I think the messaging was still muddled in terms of the actual level of risk that this poses to the country. I'm concerned that they continue to use phrases like under control and risk to the U.S. is low. I think what they mean by that is that as a snapshot in time, based on what we know now, the risk is low to some individual in a random place in the country. But I think when people hear that, they hear that as a prediction. They don't hear that as a sort of retroactive snapshot. They hear that as a forward-looking prediction. And as a forward-looking prediction, I don't think that's true. I think the risk to the United States is considerable. We do have a strong public health system. We do have a strong medical system. But so does China. Mm. And China really struggled with this. And it took extremely drastic measures in China to get this under control. We don't know that the same scenario will play out here. But I think you have to at least consider that within the range of realistic possibilities. And that's where I think saying things like the risk is low, we have this under control, send signals that don't quite accurately capture the range of scenarios.
Well, so let me ask several follow-up questions. And first of all, risk specifically of what? Of the outbreak spreading widely in the United States? Of fatalities? Because, I mean, risk is somewhat amorphous concept. So in here regarding coronavirus in the United States, what is the particular risk that we should be most cognizant of?
No, that's exactly right. And that's what they needed to be more specific about, I think, last night, is what does that risk profile look like in the United States? So from my perspective, and I think this is, you know, there are a lot of people saying this within the public health community, you know, this will pose a very significant challenge to containment in the United States. And we are likely past the point where containment is a realistic option.
Why?
We hope it will be. Because this is a disease. So to contain a disease, you have to be able to see it. You have to know where it's spreading, how it's spreading, and be able to detect it rapidly. Containment hinges upon being able to rapidly identify people who have the disease, to put them in isolation, to rapidly identify and monitor their contacts, put those people under monitoring, and isolate them if they develop symptoms before they can pass it to others. And if you can do that, with sufficient scale, that's how containment happens. But that depends on having good visibility and good surveillance on where the disease is spreading. I think the case in California that was announced last night raises real concerns about our actual level of visibility on that.
Well, let me just underscore that for a second, because I was just about to ask you that. Because this California case, the person is not known to have traveled to China and also not known to have encountered anybody in the United States who had coronavirus, at least as far as we know.
That's right.
The two in combination are quite worrisome because it didn't just like spontaneously emerge in this person's body. Does that mean that this person has come into contact with others who have coronavirus, but we don't know who they are?
Well, that's what it strongly suggests. I think we first need to see what the deeper case investigation finds. I'm sure that CDC has people who are now scrambling to do a very thorough case investigation on this individual and try to determine where the exposure or how the exposure occurred. But at least based on the initial information that this person had not traveled to China, had not had any contact with anyone who had traveled to China, or had contact with some other known case, and those are amongst the criteria that that our health system is screening for right now, this person didn't meet any of those criteria. So that does suggest strongly that there is potential transmission going on in the community there that has not been detected. And that's been a concern for some time because the testing in this country has been so limited. In the U.S., we've tested the latest figures, I think, are still under about 500 people who have been tested in this country. South Korea, in contrast, has tested 40,000. China has tested more than 300,000. So I think our ability to say definitively, as we heard in the press conference last night, that there is not transmission occurring in this country, to the best of our knowledge, that has some really big caveats on it that they're not talking about, and that is the lack of testing.
Jeremy, let me ask you about that testing really quickly. I mean, on the one hand, does it not make sense that there would be more people tested in places like China and South Korea because their rates of infection are so much higher right now? And if so, isn't the real question here in the United States, could we ramp up the amount of testing we need in time if we start seeing an uptick in infections here?
Yeah, and the concerning point is they've been trying to ramp up testing now for several weeks.
Uh-huh.
So CDC had sent out test kits to labs around the country a few weeks ago and then had to pull those back because there was a problem with the kits. It has not been made clear what that problem was or why it has not yet been fixed. But so CDC has been trying now for several weeks to supply testing kits more widely across the country so that testing could be done more widely, and they haven't succeeded in that. And that's a very puzzling thing, that's a problem we haven't been able to solve here when, as I said earlier, other countries are doing such large-scale testing.
I see. Well, I want to talk with you, Alex, a little bit about how – sorry, Jeremy, forgive me – about how when it comes to issues of public health – public communication is so very important because there has to be a balance that's struck between careful factual information while not also, you know, producing unnecessary panic. But there seems to have been a great deal of confused communication coming out of the Trump administration. And we even saw a little bit of that last night in the president's press conference. So first of all, let's listen to what the president said about whether a vaccine for coronavirus is on the way. He had previously claimed that, yes, one was on the way rather quickly. And here's what he said last night.
We're rapidly developing a vaccine, and they can speak to you. The professionals can speak to you about that. The vaccine is coming along well, and in speaking to the doctors, we think this is something that we can develop fairly rapidly, a vaccine for the future.
Fairly rapidly is really the key part of that statement there, because what does fairly rapidly mean? Well, also at last night's press conference, Dr. Anthony Fauci, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease head, gave a timeline for what the development of the vaccine would be.
At the earliest, an efficacy trial would take an additional 6 to 8 months. So although this is the fastest we have ever gone from a sequence of a virus to a trial, it still would not be any applicable to the epidemic unless we really wait about a year to a year and a half.
So, Jeremy, we had the exact same sort of misinformation and the need to correct it happen even a little earlier this week, right? There was a Senate hearing where Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf said, hey, a vaccine might be ready within several months. And then Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar had to say, that kind of timeline has simply never happened in human history. What is the impact of this misinformation and correction, the muddled communications around even just this one aspect of coronavirus?
Yeah, it was quite extraordinary to watch that in the press conference last night. And the problem is that good outbreak response runs on trust. And particularly when it gets to the point where health systems will be really strained and you need people to protect themselves not just by going to the hospital but also by altering and adapting their own behaviors, then they need credible information that they trust in order for them to do that. And this was a big lesson of the Ebola outbreak that I worked on some years ago in West Africa. That is also a disease that is driven largely by people's behavioral choices. In that case, a lot to do with funeral practices and how people were looking after sick loved ones in their homes. To get people to change those kinds of very deeply ingrained practices, they have to have trust and confidence in credible sources who are giving them information. And so it's similar here, too.
Well, we're going to dig into that a little bit more when we come back. We are talking about U.S. preparedness for coronavirus at the federal level, also at the local level as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about U.S. preparedness for coronavirus this hour. And Jeremy Kneindijk joins us from Washington. He served on a WHO advisory group about outbreaks and emergencies in 2015 and 2016. He led the U.S. government humanitarian responses to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. He's currently a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development. Jeremy, I want to explore a little bit more with you about what we can and should understand about the communications we've had from the federal government about coronavirus. Because really, I guess what I want to know is how much can we judge the federal government's ability to respond based on what they've been telling us so far. And here's why. Because I know you saw these tweets a little earlier this week from Ken Cuccinelli, the acting deputy secretary for the Department of Homeland Security. Right? He sent out a couple of tweets earlier this week where, first of all, the first one said, he wrote, has the Johns Hopkins map of coronavirus stopped working for other people or just me? He was like asking Twitter to help him get to a Hopkins map of coronavirus. And then he tweeted again, I just tried again and it looks like Hopkins put the information behind a membership wall of some kind. Seems like bad timing to stop helping the world with this previously useful resource. Here's hoping it goes back up soon. Now, many people quickly tweeted back to Mr. Cuccinelli, reminding him that he was acting deputy secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and ostensibly would have the entire apparatus of the federal government at his disposal to find information about coronavirus. So that was actually quite concerning, I have to say. But is it actually, are these sort of worrisome tweets an indication of the government's ability to respond? That's what I want to know.
It certainly raises concerns about how closely some of the senior leaders are paying attention to what their own experts are saying. During the Ebola outbreak, we relied heavily on the data that we were getting from CDC and also from the World Health Organization. And, the U.S. government has systems to answer those kinds of questions. And the Hopkins website is a great website. It's a great resource. And I think they've really done a marvelous job on it. But that shouldn't be the go-to for a U.S. government official who has access to a much wider range of information. And so I think it is, you know, what's troubling about that, as well as about the president's misstatements on the vaccine timing and so on, is I think it raises real questions about how closely members of the White House task force are actually in sync with each other and in sync with the, you know, the guidance that they're getting from the experts who work for them.
So if they're not perfectly in sync, whatever that is supposed to look like, what are the potential implications of that?
Well, the potential implications of that are that the government's response effort will underperform and will not protect the country as fully as it could. You know, I have immense respect for the men and women of CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services. I worked with many of them on Ebola. They are tremendous, just tremendous, and they are working their hearts out right now. But they are only as good as the policymakers who listen to them and who need to make decisions. And so if those policymakers are disconnected from the advice they're getting, we will not make good decisions.
I mean, I think that we can make an argument that we have seen that before. The first thing that jumped to my mind was Hurricane Katrina those many years ago. We had a similar kind of disconnect then, didn't we?
We did, and I would point more recently to Hurricane Maria, which
right.
I think is a template that concerns me more.
Why?
Well, in that, you know, what we saw in that response, and we saw a kind of smaller version of this with the whole Sharpie Gate issue later on, was a disconnect between what experts in the government were saying and between, frankly, the objective reality on the ground and what the president was saying and the picture that he wanted to present. And so, you know, with Hurricane Maria, he declared very, very early on that it was an A-plus response. Everything was going great. And anyone saying otherwise was doing so for political reasons or to whine or something like that. And he was objectively out of step with the reality on the ground. But it makes it very difficult for people working for him to actually point that out to him once he has said something like that publicly and so insisted upon it.
Mm. But, you know, while preparedness requires being prepared for worst case scenarios, there's also the obligation to not put people in a panic, because panic can actually lead to worst case scenarios. So I just want to play a little bit of what Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said to Lou Dobbs on Fox Business tonight on Tuesday. And he actually said, hey, everyone, stay calm.
We have been preparing for decades for spread of virus like this. So we know what we're doing. This is what we do. And so I think part of the message to the American people is we all need to take a bit of a deep breath here. The government is working on this. You've got the right people on this. We're working with Congress to ensure we've got the right resourcing. And the president's providing the aggressive leadership on this.
That's Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar on Fox Business's Lou Dobbs tonight on Tuesday. And Jeremy, was Azar right to say, have faith, be calm?
I think keeping the public calm is important. But the way that you keep the public calm is through transparency and candor. And, there are several ways this could go. Could go wrong. One way this goes wrong is you spook the public unnecessarily. And I think that's what Azar was talking about. You know, he's saying, don't freak out. It's not at a dangerous point right now. There's no reason to panic. But the other way that you potentially worry the public or spark panic is if it appears that the reality that people are seeing is out of step with what they've been hearing from their government. And I think that at this point is the bigger concern. The government's message, the headline messaging from the government for the past month has been that things are under control and there is a low risk. And if we were to begin seeing widespread in the United States, I think that would look quite out of touch. And that actually would spark more panic than if they had been saying, we are doing our best to contain it. We will not be able to contain it forever. And you need to be prepared for disruption. And we will let you know when we have turned that corner. That sort of a message, which you see in sort of the footnotes of what they're saying, but not in the headlines, that I think is what the American people need to be hearing. And if they are hearing that, it might spark a little more concern up front. But then when you get to the point where community spread is happening, people will feel like, okay, we were told about this. We don't need to freak out. We saw this during the Ebola response in 2014, where There was a perception that CDC had said that the risk in this country was low. And then when cases spread to two health workers in Dallas, it looked like CDC had gotten that wrong. Now, I think it was a lot more complicated than that, but that was the perception. So the perception was that one thing had been promised and another different thing had happened, and that sparked a lot of panic and kind of hysteria in the media. I think there's a risk of that here if and when we see spread in this country, and they could assuage that with a little more candor and frankness in their messaging.
Right. Well, Jeremy Kneindike, hold on for just a second here, because I want to bring into the conversation now Saskia Popescu, excuse me, Saskia. She's senior infection prevention epidemiologist with Honor Health, and she joins us from Tempe, Arizona. Saskia, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we've been talking about sort of federal level response, preparedness, coordination, and communication. Help us bring it down to the level of hospitals, which will ultimately be all the sort of little ground zeros for if and as and when coronavirus spreads in the United States. What impact does how the federal government, how the Trump administration has been communicating about coronavirus, what impact does that have on the level of hospitals and their readiness?
It has quite a significant impact. I think the biggest concern I have right now is the need to expand the case definition for screening. And when we give the messaging that we're not going to see transmission in the United States or it's not happening right now, I think that can be misleading, you know, because as Jeremy mentioned, when those cases like in California do happen, it sparks fear. And then we tend to get a lot of worried well to hospitals, which impacts our system. So hospitals right now are already, you know, busy. It's a very, very severe flu season, and there's a lot of strain already on the healthcare systems in the United States. So when we add mixed information or delays in testing and concerns for that, it can amplify those concerns in addition to the PPE shortages that we're seeing.
And so, therefore,
well, the problem right now is that we're really focused on the CDC's testing criteria to identify cases. And that is really based off of travel to China or exposure to a known case. Unfortunately, that definition is really becoming outdated. So that means, how do we identify cases in the meantime until the CDC expands that? And more so, how do we handle it when we do have more cases if hospitals are managing PPE shortages? Realistically, you know, I've seen numbers that say we need about 300 million masks for this season. And if most hospitals nationally are struggling with a couple of weeks of N95 and surgical masks to protect their healthcare workers, what will that look like if we have more transmission in the United States and that strains the system further?
Okay. So masks, protective equipment for healthcare workers or hospital workers, and as you said, perhaps there's already strain on that given the flu season we've had. What else does preparedness look like, or should it look like, at the hospital level right now?
A lot of that is communicating to frontline staff and reiterating infection control practices and screening measures. This is not a novel approach to infection control. This isn't like 2014 when we were dealing with changing guidance on PPE and infection control measures. Airborne and contact isolation and the PPE that healthcare workers need to use are tried and true measures. It's just about really reinforcing vigilance in that, appropriate donning and doffing, hand hygiene, asking patients on admission if they've had travel to an affected area, and isolating those people, really utilizing that I3 approach, the identify, isolate, and inform. And that involves spending time frontline working with staff to make sure they have the resources and education and feel supported to make sure that they're doing that, because they're already stressed right now with flu seasons and high census in each hospital. So how can we better support them with accurate information and continued guidance?
Okay. I'm trying to think of like what might be epidemics in the past that serve as good examples for what preparedness ought to be looking like. Is there one in particular that you think, Saskia, that we could learn from?
I think H1N1 was very telling, and you know, you had a lot of public fear versus in healthcare. We knew what to do, but it's a matter of how do we manage PPE challenges? How do we manage worried well coming in? So if you imagine a busy emergency department already right now, and a respiratory virus that has similar symptoms to flu and other respiratory viruses. How do you differentiate those patients? How do we make sure that we are preventing the transmission in busy emergency departments? And I think that really stresses the system more because this isn't a disease that has a widely different clinical definition or criteria so that we can rapidly identify patients right away in the triage process. H1N1 was very telling, I think, just because we saw a lot of that fear component that can stress the public and healthcare.
So, you know, the president last night pointed to a Johns Hopkins University study that showed that the U.S. is ranked number one in preparedness for a potential epidemic. That is the true Hopkins study that came out. But I think about how epidemics work, Saskia. And Jeremy, I will turn this question to you as well. But let me just start with Saskia. And that is, you know, you can have spikes in the number of infections, right? And so there seems to be this moment in which an individual hospital or a hospital group can be prepared, but are they also at the risk of being very quickly overwhelmed if the infection rate goes up rather quickly, even here in the United States?
Yeah, I think the Hopkins study was really wonderful in that it showed vulnerability across the system. And one concern I had was that America is number one in some ways, but we're not perfect. Most of those countries that have very good global health security indexes still have a lot of vulnerabilities. And when you're dealing with a hospital system or just an individual hospital that has already strained healthcare workers, limited supplies, and then you add an influx of potential patients and we have limited testing capabilities, that is going to be a problem anywhere. So realistically, when we're looking at that index and saying, oh, we're in good shape, we're wonderful, in some ways that's true. And in some ways, it's also slightly misleading because the truth is that we still have a lot of opportunity to improve. And some of that is continuously investing in healthcare biopreparedness. Now that the special pathogens tiered system is kind of, you know, being dismantled in some ways, funding hasn't been renewed for a lot of those tiers in the system. That's concerning to me because it gives this impression that perhaps we shouldn't be investing in healthcare infectious disease readiness.
Well, Jeremy Kneindike, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that that's I totally agree with Saskia. The Hopkins study did put us first, but it also pointed out that you know, that's a relative term. That doesn't mean we're in great shape. It just means we're in maybe less bad shape than everyone else. And there are still vulnerabilities in our system. I think that the delays in scaling up testing show that very clearly. And the challenge here is one of scale. I think we do have excellent systems for rapidly containing outbreaks of familiar diseases that do not go to a massive scale. I think we are less ready for a novel outbreak that we don't understand very well, that has characteristics that allow it to blend in with a lot of other diseases and has the potential to go to a very large scale. And I think if we saw in this country the kind of spread that we saw initially in Wuhan, that would strain any U.S. city's health system just as much as it did in China.
No. In U.S. cities, and then if it gets quickly beyond sort of what hospitals can manage, that problem is even further compounded, for example, in the many rural communities across the United States that don't have easy access to, you know, to a big local hospital. I mean, I think this could actually get quite serious in places rather quickly, Jeremy.
I think it could. And, you know, one of the interesting dynamics at play now is that the way that this disease is going to behave in different countries is not going to be just a reflection of, you know, the particular dynamics of the disease, but of how that disease interacts with the nature and the competence of the health system that exists in that country. China has it's an authoritarian state. They have a competent public health system and a competent medical system, and it's very centrally run. So they can just say to their whole health system, go do this, and their whole health system will jump when told to. We don't have that kind of health system in this country. We have a kind of fragmented, privately run health system that's financed not by the government but by for-profit insurance companies. And that that presents a very different sort of challenge. If someone thinks they may or may not have this, but it's going to cost them $1,400 in an insurance bill or a bill from the hospital to go get tested, that's a pretty strong disincentive to getting tested.
Well, we are talking about U.S. preparedness for coronavirus. I'm speaking today with Jeremy Kneindike and Saskia Popescu. We'll take your questions when we come back. This is On Point.
a gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about U.S. preparedness for coronavirus. And I just wanted to add a little bit of clarification for something I had mentioned previously in the show about that Johns Hopkins study that the president pointed to last night that showed that the U.S. was ranked number one in preparedness. Well, a little bit more of information there because Jeremy Kneindike pointed this out. So here's what Hopkins actually says. Quote, the U.S. scored 83.5 out of a ranking of 100, so 83.5 out of 100, ranking number one in 5 of 6 categories, prevention, early detection and reporting, rapid response and mitigation, sufficient and robust health systems, and compliance with international norms. The Hopkins study then goes on to say the U.S. ranks 19th in overall risk environment and vulnerability to biological threats, a category that assesses political and security risk, socioeconomic resilience, the adequacy of infrastructure, environmental risks, and public health vulnerabilities that may inhibit a country's ability to prevent or respond to an epidemic or pandemic, end quote. Now, Jeremy Kneindike, the question I have coming off of that is Hopkins also says that no country is really fully prepared to best manage a pandemic or epidemic like this. So where does that leave us?
No, that's 100% right. You know, I think the problematic thing about that ranking of 83 out of 100 is, you know, if you think of that in grading terms, that's about a B minus. So yeah, we're in first place, but we're in first place with a B or B minus. That's not hugely reassuring. And, you know, this is not the Trump administration's fault. It's not any administration's fault. It's every administration's fault. It's, you know, this is a weakness in U.S. preparedness and reflective of a consistent weakness in global preparedness. You know, the world generally does a really poor job of preparing for low probability, high consequence scenarios. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Well, let's go to our callers. Let's go to Katie, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Katie, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. I have 4 kids, 3 of whom are school age, and I'm hearing that we need to be prepared for the eventual reality that this will spread through the U.S., and I'm just wondering, what does preparedness look like for my family? Like, should I be expecting my kids to be out of school for weeks on end at some point, or, like, should I be, stockpiling food, or, like, what should I, my family be doing?
Yeah, Katie, good question. Saskia Popescu, you have a response for her?
I always think preparedness in terms of process planning is good. So planning to have your kiddos home from school for a couple weeks is a good plan to have now. But also, you know, preparedness, having your emergency go bag is something that should have existed before coronavirus and after coronavirus. So to me right now, a lot of it is reinforcing those respiratory illness prevention strategies, I should say, year-round, things that we know how to do, but then planning for disruptions in your daily life. If your kiddos have to stay home, if you have to telework, or if your transportation to work changes, things like that.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for that call. Let's go to Melissa, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I'm calling because I've been quite frustrated. I'm a former nurse, and my husband's a physician, and I have many family members in the medical profession. And I've been following this coronavirus thing for several weeks now, fairly closely. And I've been very frustrated with the lack of information coming from places like the WHO, which I think has the responses have been a joke. And even the media, I feel like there's been a lot of complacency in the coverage of this, and I've been concerned about potential censoring that's been going on in places like Reddit and other social media sites when information has been trying to get cross borders. And
Melissa, can I just jump in here? What are you talking about? Like censoring on Reddit? That I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, there's a lot of subreddits about the coronavirus, and there are a lot of subreddits that people will try to post things, even from from reputable news sites, and they will be taken off. Those listings will be taken off, and they will say they've violated something.
Okay.
And
well, Melissa, thank you so much for that call. Jeremy Kneindike, let me turn to you on this. I'm not quite sure what Melissa is referring to regarding Reddit, but it made me think that in the media overall, in the United States, we actually have there's been a lot of coverage, I would say. Whether or not it's good coverage, it's definitely open to an open question. But we've seen things like people bringing up the flu, and the president himself did that last night, that, you know, there's a lot of concern over coronavirus, but look at the flu. It actually kills more people every year. So has there already been sort of a fear-mongering around coronavirus that's unwarranted?
I think there's always going to be a degree of activity on social media and so on that is not well informed, and I'm not familiar with the specifics of what's going on Reddit. I know that Facebook and Twitter have been engaging with WHO and CDC and others to try to ensure that the information people are seeing on their platforms is generally accurate. I think that's a very good thing. I think misinformation at this point is a major risk, especially if we were to see large growth of cases in this country. But I think what the caller is referring to too is a frustration, a kind of feeling that they're not seeing enough information telling them what to do and
right.
what to worry about. And that's what the earlier caller said as well. I do think that space needs to be filled more. And I thought the comments from Nancy Messonnier of CDC yesterday morning, where she said, "I've talked to my kids and here's what I told them," I thought that was excellent. She was then sort of, they sort of walked that back later in the day. But I think that is the sort of candor that we should be seeing right now, because right now it feels like, you know, people are being told, trust us, we have it under control, and they're looking around them and they're not feeling confident in that. And so we need to restore that confidence.
Well, so Saskia, pick up on that thought. I mean, if for parents listening right now, or any family members, when they talk to their family members about coronavirus, what should they be telling them?
I really encourage people, first and foremost, as a preparedness strategy, to continue finding correct information through the CDC and the WHO. So when you're having conversations with worried family members and friends, because I know they're all flocking to most of us in public health right now, a lot of that is reiterating their respiratory virus protection measures, that hand hygiene, the tried and true things they know how to do, but because this is a novel situation, they feel like they should be doing more. And I think that is a complicated thing, because people want some new strategy to help protect themselves. And unfortunately, that's not really necessary. So when I have people asking me, how can I prepare, outside of, you know, what I've already mentioned, I really think information is a huge part of preparedness, because you can't just get a kit and have a plan and then stick on Facebook and your TV all the time. You need to keep up to date with the CDC and the WHO so that you are preparing yourself, but also you're aware of what's going on and sticking with the most accurate information.
So, Saskia, then on that note, just let's get some basic information out there. What are the symptoms of coronavirus? What should people be looking for? Can we distinguish it from the symptoms that come along with a bad cold or the flu?
I mean, they are, you know, very non-specific respiratory virus symptoms. So you have cough, fever, lower respiratory infection. So a lot of it is very similar to what you'd be seeing this time of year, which is what makes the diagnostics, as the testing criteria becomes less and less helpful, challenging. So astute physicians and diagnostics are important during this. And that's what we saw in California, you know, a physician having a gut feeling. But cough, fever, pneumonia, you know, severe enough to require hospitalization. Those are really the most common symptoms that we're seeing. You know, there have been some patients with gastroenteritis, but primarily it's a fever and cough. And I think so much of that reinforces the need to use hand hygiene and your cough etiquette and disinfect your surfaces, you know, those very common tried and true measures.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Scott, who's calling from Rehoboth, Massachusetts. Scott, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you today?
I've
spent over 30 years in public health, local public health in Massachusetts, and had interactions with other health departments in other states. My concern is that over that time, budgets have been decimated. Public health nursing on the local level is stressed. The whole system is stressed on the local level. And I expect that that's going to be part of the response, as it was in H1N1 and a few other things. So how does that get made up in this scenario?
Scott, thank you for that question. Jeremy Kneindike, what do you think?
That is such an important point. And it goes back to what I said earlier about how no country in the world really is adequately prepared for this kind of a scenario. I think what we've seen over the recent decades is a cycle of panic and then neglect. So every time that there is a significant public health emergency, be that Ebola, be that H5N1, be that H1N1, be that SARS, there is a burst of panic, a burst of funding, a burst of new institutions being set up, and then that recedes from memory. Those things stop getting funded. They begin falling apart. We saw on Ebola, when we went to look back at some of the work that had been done after SARS and after the anthrax attacks, much of the capabilities that had been set up after those no longer existed except on paper. We need to finance these things in a consistent, intentional way, get beyond that cycle of panic and neglect, because otherwise we're vulnerable. You can't suddenly create these capabilities from whole cloth. They need to be invested in and developed over time.
Well, the president did say last night that he may be willing to accept more emergency funding than the $2.5 billion that his administration has requested. I mean, is that what they've requested, an adequate amount? Should he be asking for more? What would it be used for?
He should absolutely be asking for more. The amount they requested is a joke. They asked for $2.5 billion. Only half of that would be new money. The other half of that would be cannibalized from other existing budgets that are already paying for other public health and related functions. To put this in perspective, so he asked for $1.25 billion of new money. Every year, according to the Simpson Center, the U.S. spends roughly $150 billion on counterterrorism preparedness and programs. So, these are both threats that have the potential to kill a lot of Americans. One of them we invest massively in. And, if you look at the investments we made in counterterrorism after 9/11, and, often rightly in my view, we didn't set up a temporary emergency counterterrorism facility and then let it be neglected and wither away. But that's exactly what we do on the disease front. So we need to take this just as seriously as we take that and invest in it with just as much robustness.
Well, Saskia, let me turn that same question to you about funding. What do you think?
I wholly agree with Jeremy. I think, if you look back in 2009 for H1N1, Congress appropriated $7 billion for that. So asking for $1.25 billion is simply not enough. But realistically, we have this habit in public health and in healthcare to only get funding when emergencies happen. Uh-huh. And then that drastically falls apart. There was an OIG report that surveyed hospital administrators and leadership about Ebola readiness since 2014. And there were a lot of gaps, and a lot of them said, there's a lot of competing priorities, and this is just not something that we view as a main one. And it's very costly to maintain that level of preparedness. And in fact, 30% of them couldn't tell you where they fell on that tiered hospital approach. So I think sustainability is a challenge that we're seeing internationally, but also nationally, when it comes to maintaining readiness, because we're just not putting the support behind that. We have huge gaps in critical positions at government levels for global health security, and that trickles down to public health departments, to healthcare, and maintaining that level of priority.
There's one other thing about how we've seen the global response to coronavirus unfold so far. And Saskia, I wanted to ask you about these lockdowns. That's one thing for China, which has an authoritarian government, to lock down many tens of millions of people. I mean, the numbers are quite staggering. But when we saw that also happen in certain communities in Italy, I just wonder, I mean, you're as a health official, is that an effective way of containment? I mean, because we run the risk of denying people the freedom of movement here to contain an epidemic, which it may be almost hard, if not impossible, to contain.
quarantine is a very tricky thing. And for that to work effectively, you have to have, you know, public trust, which is something Jeremy's reiterated, the need for transparency, but they also have to agree with it and comply with it. But also, it really only works if you have a disease that is being transmitted when a person is asymptomatic. So if you look at something like measles, where you're highly infectious for the 4 days prior to the rash onset, that's something that would be more effective in quarantine. But for something like this novel coronavirus, people really are only infectious when they're symptomatic. So you have to ask the question in terms of, is this a realistic approach and does it work scientifically? But also, is it going to increase panic and fear and then discourage transparency, people seeking medical care, people going to flee that area, which is what we saw when it was enacted in China? You know, 40% of the population left Wuhan.
That's right.
And that's, to me, that's a big red flag that these measures don't necessarily work and we really need to focus on more pragmatic efforts.
Right. Well, so Jeremy, we've got about a minute and a half left here. My final question links, I want to go back to the federal government level here, because we must acknowledge that there is a human cost when we see incompetence amongst our leadership. I mean, there's a human cost to muddled responses, lack of coordination, underfunding. You know, we talked about Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Maria. We have seen what can happen when we're not on our game here. So what do you think is one of the most important things the Trump administration can and should be doing regularly now in the next coming weeks and months around coronavirus in order to assure people that there is a competent response unfolding?
So process management within the federal government is deeply unsexy, but so, so critically important. They are in a point that reminds me a bit of the point that we were in the Obama administration over the summer of 2014, when we had lots of different parts of the government working within their own lanes, but not all joining up together in a coherent and effective way. And, it took the appointment of Ron Klain as the czar to do that for us. Maybe Mike Pence will be able to deliver that. I think that's going to be critically important.
Well, Jeremy Kneindike is Senior Policy Fellow at the Center for Global Development. He's a former director of USAID's Office on U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance, led the U.S. government's humanitarian responses to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa as well. Jeremy Kneindike, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Saskia Popescu, Senior Infection Prevention Epidemiologist with Honor Health in Tempe, Arizona. Saskia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you go to onpointradio.org, folks, we have a link to a guide for how to prepare your home for coronavirus. That guide is from NPR. It's on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.